Next case for argument, U.S. Bank versus Sullivan Moore, Ms. Mannix.
Joan Mannix, on behalf of Appellant Fisher & Fisher. This is Fisher & Fisher's appeal from the entry by the District Court of Rule 11 sanctions and sanctions pursuant to 28 U.S.C. Section 1927 against Fisher & Fisher, the law firm as an entity, versus any individual attorneys.
You know, I'm going to ask you to explain something because I'm not certain I understand the distinction that you're making when you say that Fisher & Fisher didn't agree to a firm-wide sanction, but merely stipulated that any sanction should run against the firm rather than the individual attorneys. Because isn't a sanction that runs against the firm one that would impact all persons in the firm rather than a few individual attorneys?
I think a firm-wide sanction would, I think the distinction lies with you can take some sort of measure against the firm without singling out individual attorneys. That would be the distinction between without making the sanction run as against every member of the firm, and in this case, every member of the firm.
Well, who would it run against? If it's not a sanction directed against a named individual, then who does it run against? Who has to see the 16-hour videotape?
Well, for example, in this instance, we suggested that everybody who had any connection in anybody who had any involvement or in connection in the
but
litigation.
That's inconsistent with the notion of a firm rather than an individual sanction.
And I was going to say, and all the principals of the firm, which are Fisher & Fisher. I believe
well, that's identifying a responsible group and making the sanction against them. That doesn't sound like a firm-wide sanction.
I do believe that there can be a distinction between saying you were specifically, the way I think of an individual sanction is this person was specifically responsible for this act of what we consider to be sanctionable conduct. Therefore, I'm going to impose this sanction against this person. We, you know, agreed with the court in response to the court's request for stipulation that the sanction wouldn't single out and identify, for example, each individual. This individual was responsible for this aspect.
It seems like a really trivial distinction because only the responsible people, on your view, have to watch the videotape. So clearly the sanction is limited to them.
We didn't
sanction against them, not against the firm.
But we did also include the principal attorneys as well.
Right, because they're responsible. It's their firm.
Correct. And then, but there's the problem of people who, I mean, aren't even members of the firm yet. And I still don't understand that.
Well, that's the difference between the firm being responsible and individuals being responsible. And you're saying only certain individuals should be responsible. And people who join after and so on shouldn't be. Well, in other words, you don't want it firm-wide.
Well, we did. I mean, we agreed.
You want to have your cake and eat it. You don't want these people named as the targets of the sanctions, but you want the sanction confined to them.
I don't know that that was really our argument. We did argue that the sanctions should still be tailored to deter similar conduct, which is the guide for Rule 11 sanctions, and we suggested that imposing it against this particular group of individuals would be sufficient to deter misconduct on a firm-wide level. But we accepted responsibility, and the trial judge or the district judge basically said, if you're suggesting that you want to renege on your stipulation, then tell me who you think is responsible. And our response was, we aren't suggesting that any individuals should be specifically singled out or that we're reneging on our stipulation. But the whole firm-wide sanction issue came up in the context of, at the hearing, the judge's clerk asked Fisher and Fisher's counsel, well, what happened in connection with this motion to correct Scrivener's error? What was looked at, what was done in connection with that motion? The response was, I don't know. That was done by an attorney who was no longer with the firm, Ken Johnson. And we didn't, it was just a statement of fact.
Does it matter whether he's with the firm or isn't with the firm?
Well, I do think it matters, because if you're looking at sanctioning the firm for conduct that's been committed by an attorney who's no longer with the firm, and that was ran contrary to the firm's enunciated policies, that certainly does.
Why was he fired for this?
The record, I don't know the answer to that question. I don't believe so. That is not in the record, and I assume that if he had been fired.
Why should the firm have a benefit because the particularly negligent person left voluntarily?
Well, I don't know that he left voluntarily. I don't know that he was fired in connection with this particular incident. But I do believe that those considerations are relevant if somebody is no longer with the firm and took action that was contrary to what the firm's policies were. That's certainly relevant to whether or not a sanction is appropriate against the firm as an entity. I'd just like to turn to highlighting a few of the issues that the court has acknowledged, or this court has acknowledged, that an abuse of discretion occurs if a sanction ruling is based on a clearly erroneous assessment of the evidence.
I don't know. I mean, evicting someone without service seems pretty serious.
Undoubtedly so. But
a firm overwhelmed by volume, I assume, treats these things as, you know, rote and is not careful. I mean, obviously, Lori didn't look at the documents attached to the complaint, since the documents contained a different address.
Correct, but I do believe that you have
That's
to look at what she did look at.
Well, I don't understand that.
Yeah, what's a little confusing to me is that the process server was able to come up with an old address for Ms. Sullivan Moore by looking at her credit reports, but was unable to come up with her proper address using the same credit report. I mean, do you have any idea why that would be so?
I have no idea, other than that she had lived apparently at both these properties. Apparently, at least at some point, she was not living at 7744 South Carpenter, because the other tenant at the South Union address had said she had left 5 months earlier. And all I can say is that it appeared that the special process server, the record shows, he did seek to find her at 7742. He identified another address for her at South Union. He consulted, you know, license registration and a variety of other sources to try and locate a correct address. It's not as though this was treated cavalierly and there was no attempt or meaningful attempt to find her, because there clearly was. I would just like, the district judge's ruling is, in our view, clearly based on a variety of mistaken facts. The judge found that there was a cover-up by Fisher and Fisher, and there's simply no, that is just unsubstantiated by the record. There was never any cover-up by anybody. Mike Fisher is an associate with the firm. He was not sent on September 3rd to try to finesse the situation as a partner. He showed up. He made an objection that takes is an instant, a glimmer in the record, basically that he objected to a non-attorney representing a party. His objection was overruled, and he proceeded. There was never any attempt to foreclose Sullivan Moore from approaching the court, to intimidate her. She was expressly asked by the judge whether she was able to speak for herself. She stated that she was. But nonetheless, the district judge found that this was part of this, quote, cover-up, to try and preclude her from, you know, bringing the truth before the court. There are other facts as well that are just simply unsubstantiated and that drove the district court's sanction ruling, including the finding that this episode somehow hastened Sullivan's Moore death from coronary artery disease. there's simply nothing in the record to substantiate that, nor is there any record to substantiate a pattern of misconduct or any pattern that would suggest that this firm was acting in a rote, cavalier-type manner and just filing a lot of cases and letting the judges sort them out, as Judge Posner had suggested that might be the case. There's nothing in this record to suggest that that was the case. I don't know if I have any time left, but I guess I'll reserve whatever I do for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Mannix.
You.
Mr. Reeses?
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Michael Reeses, and along with Ryan Mahoney of my law firm, I'm here today on behalf of the appellee. This appeal arises out of orders that imposed non-monetary sanctions on the plaintiff law firm under Rule 11 in Section 1927. Our law firm was appointed as counsel for the appellee during those proceedings. Because the sanctions imposed were within the broad powers of the district court, we submit that the sanctions were not an abuse of discretion and that the orders should be affirmed in their entirety. The order set out in detail, and one is tempted to say in excruciating detail, the basis for the exercise of the district court's discretion in this case. The law firm was not sanctioned for having committed a mere typographical error in the pleadings. The district court made it clear on the record that it gave the law firm the benefit of the doubt by calling it an honest mistake. It was what the law firm did after it discovered that initial mistake in the complaint that multiplied vexatiously and unreasonably the proceedings that led to Ms. Sullivan Moore being evicted from the premises and then having to go to court about a month later in response to a motion for an order of repossession. The proceedings that were multiplied were basically four. First, you had the order or the proceeding from May 28, 2003, where there was an order of approval of sale. Secondly, you had the ill-fated motion to correct Scrivener's error that took place 3 weeks later on June 18, 2003. Third, you had the eviction itself, which took place on August 1, 2003. And then fourth, you had the motion for an order of repossession, which is when everything began to unravel for the law firm. Now, once the law firm learned back in May of 2003 that the address in the complaint was a mistake, it should have investigated to learn whether the attempt at personal service was defective because the attempt was made at the wrong address. The law firm knew or should have known that without a valid attempt at personal service, that service by publication was defective, and that without valid service, that every order that was entered leading up to the foreclosure and sale was void and that every proceeding would have to begin anew. Instead of investigating service, which would have only required that they look at their own file, all that the law firm did was to file a motion to correct Scrivener's error. And as the district court pointed out in the first order of sanctions, that motion, even when it was granted, could not have cured the defect, a point that is not contested on appeal by the appellant law firm. If the law firm had acted reasonably, however, in discovering the mistake in service, Ms. Sullivan Moore would not have been evicted from the premises, and that is, as I think was referred to during oral argument this morning, a serious matter. That, however, was not the end of it. After the family retook possession, the law firm prepared and filed a motion for a renewed order of possession, this time sent to the correct address. And it was only then when Ms. Sullivan Moore came to court on September 3 that it was discovered that by the law clerk for the district court judge, from looking at the court file, that service had never been properly attempted at the correct address. Those proceedings obviously would have been obviated if Ms. Sullivan Moore, I'm sorry, if the law firm had simply looked at its own file ahead of time. There is a reference to this morning.
I lost the thread. Yes. You said that she was evicted in August.
Yes.
And September 3rd was the motion to repossess. But did something happen between then?
Well, what happened was when the family, using perhaps self-help, retook the premises.
Oh, I see. After being evicted,
yes.
She moved back in.
That's right.
And that's when they...
And the sheriff would not start the proceeding, the eviction again, without a new order of possession. Hence, the hearing on September 3rd. There's a claim this morning that there was no.
Oh, I see. So the September 3rd, that was Fisher and Fisher's motion to repossess.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. Now, there's a suggestion this morning that somehow there was no cover-up. And I think the point here is that I don't think that really helps them much to say there was no cover-up, because an empty head and a pure heart is no defense. And the fact remains that they had a duty to inquire, and it was something that was so easy to discover if they had simply looked at their own file. And it's demonstrated by the fact that all you had on September 3rd was the clerk for the judge looking at what's on the computer system to discover that they never attempted service at the proper address. It was so easy. And I think that is what was behind the judge's sanction. There's this question about whether it could be individual or firm-wide, and I just want to say that about this. The fact of the matter is that in this case, you had a classic example of the right hand and the left hand not knowing what each other was doing. You had one lawyer who was involved in the foreclosure proceeding. You had another lawyer who was involved in the eviction proceeding. You had a third lawyer who was not being properly supervised, who made the wrong motion to correct Scrivener's error. Now, I think that although they come up here and say that mistakes were made, but no one is responsible, no one's accountable, or only a few of the principals should have to take the course, simply fails to take into account that the problem was with how the firm was practicing in terms of having different lawyers do different things without any one lawyer being responsible. And I think that the sanction was reasonable under the circumstances. It was not imposed against the bank. The bank was allowed to proceed with its foreclosure proceeding. The sanction was not monetary. The sanction was merely educational in having the lawyers with the firm having to attend a 16-hour course, 4 four-hour sessions, and have the individual lawyers who appear before the judge for a period of 2 years submit an affidavit attesting that they had attended the course or seen the videotape. They could take that whenever they wanted to fit within their schedule. We would suggest that because of the circumstances in the case, that the sanction was tailored to meet the individual situation, and consequently, there was no abuse of discretion. For all the reasons in our brief and appearing in the record, we ask that you affirm the orders of sanctions in their entirety. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Reeses. Ms. Mannix, how much time does she have?
30 seconds.
Okay, well, we'll give you a little more than that.
Thank you. Just very briefly, we addressed a cover-up because that was what the district court found was, and I quote, the egregious conduct here. That was what the district judge based his discretion on.
Mr. Reese is correct that when you sought the new possession order, when you moved to repossess, you had the correct address now, right? You had the correct address.
Correct, but it is also correct that notice had been given to her in May 2003, when there was a question about having the incorrect address, and they had the special process server check to see if that she was at that time at least at 7744, and she was served with the motion for order to approve sale at that address, although she did not respond to that and she didn't come to court at that time.
Wait, I've lost you.
I understood Mr. Reese's to suggest that the first notice that Ms. Sullivan Moore had with regard to...
No, what he said was that the September 3rd, by September 3rd, you knew her correct address, 7744, but she hadn't been served at that address.
It is correct that she had not been served with process at that address.
Right.
She had been served in May of 2003.
But now, wasn't that a pretty serious oversight?
My understanding, at least the affidavits state, that there was not an understanding that she had been residing at 7744 at the time of the initiation of the litigation, although by May 2003 she was there. And at least part of that confusion was occasioned by her own application that said her present address was 7742. I mean, clearly there were mistakes made, but you have a very unusual situation where apparently she listed her own wrong address or she listed her correct address, and that's the address we tried to serve her at.
You said that something subsequent to the initial notice was served at her house, the proper address?
In May 2003, when it came to light that there was an incorrect common address in the pleadings, that it was 7744 instead of 7742, she was served with a motion, a copy of the motion to approve the order approving sale.
So it was something that was part of things that the normal process, and now that went to the correct address as opposed to the wrong address.
Correct. And the attorneys who sent that simply did not realize that she had never been properly served. They just realized that at least at that time she was at that address, and there was no attempt not to provide her with service. And she did have at least that much notice of what was going on before the eviction. And I don't mean to suggest that an eviction is not a serious thing, but there was certainly no conduct by Fisher & Fisher that, as I said before, was cavalier or vexatious or intended to cause any of this. And again, I do think that it merits consideration the fact that either this mistake was injected into the whole process by Sullivan Moore herself, or in fact, at the time she filled out her loan application, she did live at 7742 when the attempted service was in fact valid at that time.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you
both, counsel.